Please.
Are you an IT leader, a change agent? Then the Green IT and Cloud Computing Summit, April 20th and 21st at the Ritz-Carlton Tysons Corner, is an event you shouldn't miss. Hear from top government leaders and private industry experts as they discuss real-world projects. Network with thought leaders and decision-makers to better understand the green IT and cloud computing opportunities emerging in federal, state, and local governments. And leave with actionable ideas, advice, and a network of experts. That's the Green IT and Cloud Computing Summit, April 20th and 21st. For more information, visit greenitdc.com.
Newsmakers on In Depth with Francis Rose, weekday afternoons 3 to 7.
Christy Romero is the acting Special Inspector General for TARP.
We ended up questioning two-thirds of Venable's bill, which was over $676,000. And we concluded that OFS practices create an unacceptable risk that Treasury and really the American taxpayer is overpaying for legal services.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning. Welcome to For Your Benefit. Today is Monday, April 18th, and we are here this morning to talk about benefits. You know, sometimes we kind of veer off of that subject with taxes and financial planning, but today the focus is really going to be on federal retirement benefits and issues related to retirement planning. So I'm looking forward to the show today. James Marshall is here. He's a retirement specialist, as I am. We both teach for NITP. Welcome, James.
Oh, thank you very much, Tammy. And I'm so glad that we're not talking about taxes or financial planning today, because I am not a tax planner. I'm not a financial planner. And wouldn't even know how to address half those questions that Bob...
But sometimes we get confused for that, I think, when we start teaching about benefits in the classroom.
Sure, sure. And what I like about our job, Tammy, is what we do and what we teach are based on laws and regulations, which have nothing to do with what's going on in the marketplace, what's going on with investments and everything. And the stuff that we share with folks and we help employees understand, federal employees, when they're planning for retirement, is, you know, what their options are. And they're defined by law. And so all these defined benefits, which are defined by law, they can make the best decisions for themselves as long as they're clear with what their options are. And that's what we do, is we help them understand what's
right. It's either is or it isn't.
That's
There's
right.
usually a definitive answer to the questions that we get asked. And it's always nice to say, and here's a resource to show you where it says that.
Yeah. And you sit down and you show someone, if you do this, this is what you're going to get. Or if you do that, this is what you're going to get. And then let them decide, you know, what's the best option for them. Because what's right for one person may not be right for their coworker or their neighbor, for example.
Yeah, the only caveat we have is that we are subject to the changes in the law that Congress will sometimes propose. And this year seems to be one that there are some changes on the horizon. So we always have to keep alert that what we say today could change in some respects tomorrow.
That's true. America is a different place than it ever has been before, I think. And it's, of course, we're always changing. But there are a lot of things that are going on in America that they're taking a closer look at some of the federal benefits. And there may be some things that are here today that may not be here tomorrow. We always have to remind our clients about that.
Yeah, I think reading the newspaper tells us that's the case. Well, the other person we have in the studio with us today is Ann Vincent. We're happy to have Ann with us today. She is the supervisor of the show today, I see from reading the overview. She is our business development director with NITP. She's got a great sense of humor, and she sometimes is the one who will ask the questions that many of you have sent in to us by email, which we did get quite a few this last week on the subject of benefits. So good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Tammy.
Glad to have you with us today.
I'm happy to be here.
And Ann and I have worked together for many, many years.
Oh, many years. Over 20, I think.
I think it has been. Yeah. We're still waiting for our 20-year pin.
That's right. I hope you're listening, Bob.
Yeah, Bob Lyons, as you might have guessed by now, and it is April 18th, which is the tax deadline date, so he's probably head about to explode this afternoon. And he can breathe a sigh of relief tomorrow that he can wait now till all those extensions come due in October that he's probably filing for people today as they procrastinated till the last minute. And we're hoping that your home today may be listening as well, maybe doing your last minute taxes. Maybe it's spring break and your kids are off. So if you have any questions for us and you want to call in this morning on Monday, April 18th, between 10 right now and maybe about 10:55 a.m., the number here in the studio is 1-877-936-9333. It's 1-877-936-9333. If you're listening to one of the archive versions or after this show has aired live, feel free to send us your email, and our email address is for your benefit, just as it sounds, one word, for your benefit at nitpinc.com. That's nitpinc.com. And we'll be happy to answer your question on an upcoming show, or if we need to, we'll send you an email back and answer your question right away. So let's go ahead and get started. One of the things I did want to talk about, because we're now entering the third week of the federal long-term care open season, so I thought it might be appropriate to spend just a couple of minutes of the show talking about what that open season means and maybe a little bit about who might be looking at this open season, what's kind of unique about the federal long-term care plan. Have you been getting questions about long-term care insurance in your seminars due to this open season, James?
Actually, surprisingly, a lot of the classes that I've been teaching for the past 2 weeks, the employees didn't even realize that there was an open season.
Yeah, maybe because we were so focused on furlough and government shutdowns and that kind of thing that it overwhelmed the initial rollout of this open season. But it will run through June 24th, and it's going to be open to, everybody. It's the federal long-term care insurance is open to everybody who's eligible. That includes employees, retirees, spouses of employees, spouses of retirees, same-sex partners of employees and retirees, and also for the employee group, their parents, their in-laws, and even their children.
And that's what I usually remind folks in the classes that, it's not just about yourselves, but it could be your parents, they're healthy now, but do they have a strategy to protect themselves against, the cost of long-term care if they ever need it? And the odds are, I think, what about one out of every two Americans at some point in their life might need long-term care.
Well, the older you get, the higher the odds get. They say once you're 65 years old, your chances are 50-50.
That's right.
That at some point in your lifetime, you'll need long-term care. If you make it to the ripe old age of 80, you got a pretty darn good chance of, by the end of your lifetime, needing at least a specific amount of long-term care. It may not be permanent, but it might be recovery from a stroke or something like that.
Some of the stats that I was looking at a few weeks ago said, on average, the long-term care could last anywhere from 3 to 5 years. And so you got to start asking yourself some questions. Number one, how much does long-term care cost?
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to keep in mind when you start researching this, what it costs today may be completely different what it'll cost 30 or 40 years down the road when you finally need long-term care. That's if you ever need it.
Right.
But the point that you brought up about employees being able to sign up their parents and in-laws is, maybe to think about them. If it's going to be you and your siblings that are paying out of pocket to make sure that they're comfortable when they actually, if they ever need long-term care, then maybe you might want to think about getting them signed up while you're an employee.
Right.
Because you can always you can always take care of yourself or your spouse, for example, if you're married after you retire. But your parents and your in-laws, you can only get them signed up with the federal program while you're an employee.
Right. And just give you an example of how that could benefit you as the employee. Give you a personal example. My mother-in-law ended up moving in with my sister-in-law for her last 2 years of life. And my sister-in-law provided full-time care. She basically put her own life and job on hold during that time. She wasn't able to work because my mother-in-law needed her there to provide meals and supervision and help her with dressing and bathing because she was pretty much become an invalid at that point. Well, the federal long-term care has a unique home care benefit, kind of a aging in place benefit. And part of that includes the payment to an informal caregiver. So since even though my mother-in-law moved in with my sister-in-law in her home, you can use that benefit so that the daily benefit of your long-term care can be used to pay that family member that doesn't normally live with you that daily benefit. So if she had long-term care insurance and if maybe it paid a benefit, let's say of $150 a day, she could use that benefit to pay my sister-in-law to provide the care that she needed that would offset the cost of her losing the wages from her own job.
So the difference was that she wasn't living with her before.
Right.
When she needed the care, as she moved in.
And she was eligible. Now, if it's your spouse who lives in the same home with you, you don't have that same benefit. But if you're going to hire someone to come in and move in with you, or if you're going to go move in with that family member, then that would qualify for that in-home informal caregiver benefit. The one unique thing, and why I wanted to talk about this today, because we are in this open season, and as I said before, it's open all the time. You can always sign up for federal long-term care insurance, but specifically for employees, spouses of employees, and same-sex partners of employees, this particular group during this open season will only have to answer either 7 or 9 questions about their health.
Less underwriting,
kind of an abbreviated application, so that if you thought maybe something in your health history would prevent you from getting this kind of insurance, this might be the time to sign up, because they're not going to ask you as many questions about pre-existing conditions. You know, mainly the questions on the underwriting application deal with somebody who's already diagnosed with an illness that might result in long-term care, such as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease or MS or things like that. But if you've had heart disease or if you've had cancer, those are not questions on this new application. So this might be the time to consider it, especially if you're in your 40s, 50s, or 60s, which is the prime age where people start to look at purchasing this kind of insurance for their own future, or, like, as you said, James, maybe for their parents.
Yeah, it's worth looking into. It's one of those things that, and a lot of folks think that, you know, they have certain health conditions that they think are make them uninsurable, but they got to remind themselves that what makes you uninsurable for life insurance is not always the same thing that makes you uninsurable for long-term care insurance.
Exactly. Life insurance companies are looking how quickly you're going to die, where long-term care insurance companies are looking how long you'll live with that illness and what type of care you might need during the course of that progression of that illness. So you have to think in terms of things that might result in eventually needing maybe care in a nursing home or assisted living, or the situation like my mother-in-law where she was cared for by a family member in her home.
Yeah.
So those are things. But the thing we talked about with parents, you, if you do want to sign your parents up, or if your parents wish to purchase a policy, they can certainly do that. But they will have to fill out the full underwriting application, which has about 40 questions about, about health.
Now, the parents, I mean, the employee doesn't have to pay for that premium, do they?
They want to, but your parents could certainly buy it for themselves.
So your parents may be able to financially afford this premium themselves. It's just that they don't have a strategy. If their strategy is that you're going to be the one that takes care of them, and that's not part of your plan, then there's nothing wrong with looking in long-term care insurance as a potential strategy to help, you know, protect your parents. You know, let them have a strategy by educating them on what programs are available. So that way it could help you guys from you know, having to stop working, for example, earlier than you wanted to, or to you know, keep your own income from being derailed.
Yeah, if anyone wants to see that abbreviated underwriting application, or you want to hear or see some of the unique features of the federal plan versus if you were to shop around and buy a private plan, the website for that is ltcfeds.com, not .gov. So it's just long-term care feds, ltcfeds.com. And what's new for this open season is they put up kind of like a consultant on the homepage. So you can click on that consultant icon, and you'll have a person there talking to you about how the price structure works, how the long-term care insurance works, you know, who needs it, how much does it cost, how do you shop for it. So there's a lot of assistance, I think, on the website to help somebody decide if this is something they need to purchase, if it's cost effective for them, and what does it cost, because they have a calculator right there that's very user friendly.
Yeah, and they're not there to sell you anything that you don't need. They're not going to try to over insure you or scare you into something you don't need. They're not there to make money off of anybody.
They're there to help folks design the plans, just like any other insurance, whether it's life insurance or health benefits, and in this case, long-term care insurance, give you enough information so you can decide if this is something you want to purchase for yourself or your family members, to help prevent a catastrophic impact down the road that you'd have to finance out of pocket, or you'd have to rely on a family caregiver to give up part of their life or part of their savings to help provide for you.
Tammy, we have those two radio shows coming up, too.
Oh, that's right.
May 2nd and June 9th with the long-term care partner. So that's a perfect format for people to call in with their questions.
That's right. We'll have Beth O'Brien, and we'll also have Paul Fort on
yes.
those shows, which are right up there on the federal long-term care chain of command. And
correct.
They'll be able to answer any question you have about the federal program and how it's structured and who might be a good candidate for
correct.
It.
Correct. Yes.
So, yeah, the one unique feature, and I'll just kind of recap this and we can move on, is the informal caregiver benefit that lasts for up to 500 days of your policy. So that's a good year and a half worth of benefits for that. It also has a oversight. So let's say that you apply for your benefit and you get denied by the long-term care company. Well, you can get a third-party person to look at that and re-look at your denial to see if maybe they you should have been approved, which is kind of unique to the federal plan as well. So that's another aspect of the federal plan you may not find someplace else.
Yeah, that's some of the horror stories that I hear about some of the private sector plans is they don't always provide the benefits when you actually need them.
Right.
I've heard that. And, you know, it's not so, this long-term care insurance, first off, hasn't been around for, you know, as long as
life insurance and other types of insurance.
So they're
right.
kind of new to
testing the waters.
That's right. And so some of these, I've heard horror stories in different states, you know, with some of these private sector plans where people have been paying premiums for 20 years, and also they needed the care, and they just don't have it because they didn't meet some specific requirement that was in the fine print.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
And another thing, I guess we're talking today more about aging in place. You know, nobody wants to move into a nursing home, I don't think, unless you really had no other choice. You know, we'd all like to stay in our own homes and sleep in our own beds and that kind of thing. So with the federal plan, you can use some of your benefit even during the waiting period, even during kind of the deductible period, if you want to call it that. If you wanted to have some home modifications, you want to have somebody come in and evaluate your home where you might need some grab bars, you might need a ramp for a wheelchair or stair lift, things like that to make it able so that you could stay at home and maybe get care for yourself. So that's another thing that they provide. And to get help with that, they offer usually registered nurses that you can call and say, you know, here's my situation. Can you help me find the best price for this? Or what are some of my options? Are there facilities near where I live? And they provide that kind of service as well. So I think the federal plan is well structured.
One-stop shop where you can get the beginning and end
of long-term
care.
That's right. Well, that's that for long-term care. So please look into that if you have a need for it or if you haven't already purchased it. But now let's move on to some other things, because we did get, what, six or seven questions that came in throughout the week, and Ann's got those in front of her. So you want to read us the first one that's in front of you there, Ann?
This one's about health insurance for the survivor after a federal retiree dies. A retiree can select the maximum survivor benefit. This says 55% of the federal employee's monthly annuity, where the federal retiree can reduce the monthly annuity by stipulating a lesser percentage. Does the retiree have to select the 100% level in order to keep the health benefits for the survivor, or can the retiree select a lesser percentage? If yes to the second choice, at what percent will the survivor not qualify for the health benefit?
I think James is going to start off answering this maybe just with an overview of what they're talking about.
Yeah, I think we're talking about a CSRS employee here, because they're talking about 55% of a benefit. Because under FERS, a full survivor benefit.
And they're also talking about an election you make when you're retiring.
That's right. Yeah, they're talking about elections. But his primary concern, it sounds like, is health insurance for their surviving widow or widower. So two things have to be in place at the time of an employee or a retiree's death. You know, whether you're a FERS employee or a CSRS employee, two things have to be in place to qualify a widow or widower to be entitled to the FEHB coverage, health insurance, for the rest of their lives, or potentially for the rest of their lives. Number one, you have to have a minimum survivor benefit payable.
And that's what they're asking about.
That's what they're asking about. And under CSRS, I saw that email, the percentages, I think he was getting those off of an estimate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm familiar with some of the software that produces these estimates. They just show you percentages. But the actual application doesn't ask for a percentage. The application for retirement, when you're CSRS, it actually asks you to fill in the blank. And it's 55% of blank a year. So you got to do some reverse math that your local retirement officer can help you figure out.
Right. I think that's misleading, because I know some of the software doesn't express it that way.
No,
so
they
the
don't.
Employees get confused as to how do you provide a partial survivor benefit for my spouse to make sure that he or she doesn't lose the health insurance.
That's right.
And as you just mentioned, you have to express it as 55% of either my retirement, which would be the maximum, or 55% of something less than my retirement.
Yeah.
No minimum.
That's right. Well, the minimum is there's $22 a year.
Which would be a dollar a month.
That's a dollar a month. It'll cost you a big fat nickel a month out of your retirement check. That's the smallest that they can reduce your pension by.
And that would still technically
that
be a
qualify.
Survivor benefit.
And the law says potentially payable. So even if there was a divorce decree on file that says a former spouse gets the benefit, if there was a divorce decree on file that says a former spouse gets the benefit, for example, that leaves nothing for a current spouse, and the retiree passes away. As long as that retiree at the time of retirement elected some sort of survivor benefit, either a partial or a full survivor benefit, whether they're CSRS or FERS, as long as the benefit is potentially payable to the widow or widower, they can still continue the health insurance.
Even if they have to pay it out of pocket.
That's right.
Right. And as long as the other second thing you were going to get to, as long as they had self and family
that's
coverage.
That's right. At the time of death. So the two requirements are a minimum survivor benefit. Under FERS, that's 25%. You know, you don't have to fill in the blank under FERS. But CSRS, that's 55% of $22 a year.
Right.
Minimum survivor benefit, and the second requirement is a self and family plan at the time of your death. Whether you're an employee or retiree, as long as those two things are in place at the time of your death, you know, you're good to go. And, of course, as an employee, there's no election required for survivor benefits. If you die as a CSRS employee, there's this automatic survivor benefit. If you die as a FERS employee and you're married with 10-plus years of credible service under your belt, there's an automatic full survivor benefit that a lot of FERS employees aren't even aware of.
Don't even know about. It's built-in benefits.
Yeah, that's right. No election required. But you have to be in a self and family plan, though. That's the other part.
In order for the spouse to continue.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, we do have a caller who's calling in live online this morning, so we're going to go to our caller. Good morning. Okay. Yeah, maybe we're hearing the feedback from the caller's radio. Is she still there? Good morning. Hello, caller. Are you with us? Nope. Oh, cool. Come back to it if we can get you back on the line. In the meantime, and we have another question that came in.
Yes. This person said they will be 66 years old in 2011 this year. I'm still working under CSRS, the person says. Should I apply for Social Security benefits of about $700 per month on my 66th birthday? I have 2 years and 10 months of military time for a total of 37 years service. If I retire next year, should I buy back my military time, and how will applying for and receiving Social Security benefits affect my annuity?
We got two questions there.
Yes. That first buy back military time is always a big one.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we've got someone who has apparently post 56 military service, and they're a CSRS employee who's thinking about retirement, and we already know that they're eligible for Social Security. So that's question number one. Do we pay for that military deposit? Question number two, the employee is not retiring yet, turns age 66, which for someone who turns 66 this year, that is their full retirement age for Social Security. So do they start receiving the benefit while they're still working, or can they wait till afterwards? What's the strategy in doing that? So which one do you want to take first, James?
Let's do the military service first.
Go ahead.
I got military service myself under my belt, so I'd like to help out everybody, because there's probably not the only person listening that has military service. It's a federal employee. But you also got to remember that what we're talking about right now is specifically for this employee who's CSRS. The laws are different under FERS, so we're just going to address this as a CSRS question.
Well, FERS is easy.
FERS is easy. You pay for it, you get credit, or you don't pay for it and don't get credit.
Exactly.
Yeah, but CSRS.
A little more complicated.
Yeah, it's a little more complicated, and he gets caught by the Catch-62 rule, which says that if you're eligible for Social Security benefits as a CSRS retiree at the date of retirement or age 62, whichever is later, in this case we're talking about date of retirement, which is later, that you will not receive credit in the computation of your pension unless you have paid your military deposit before you retire. So mm-hmm. in this case, it might behoove this person to maybe think about paying his deposit, because if he doesn't pay it, he will not receive credit for almost 3 years of service in the right. computation of pension. If his high average salary, for example, was $100,000, he would be missing out on $3,000 a year for the 6,000. Rest of his life. Oh, I'm sorry, you're right, 2% at CSRS, that's $6,000 a year.
I think it's the best investment this person
Absolutely.
Might ever make.
Where else can, you know, he might only owe like maybe $5,000 or $6,000 total, including interest. You know, his interest in most cases for CSRS is going to go back to 1986 mm-hmm. Based on variable interest rates. But that interest, you know, including his original military deposit, and he probably will get that money back within the first couple of years of collecting his pension.
Sometimes within the first year, depending on when they served in the military and what rank they were.
That's right.
Because they owe initially 7% of their military base pay. And if this is somebody who was Vietnam era,
yeah, he didn't
base
make very
pay
much.
Was like $100 a month.
That's right. So the bad news is you didn't make that much money back then, but the good news is you don't owe a lot of money for
exactly.
your military deposit.
This is the one time it pays to be low ranking and serving
right.
long ago.
That's right.
But yeah, I would say that really could end up being the best investment this person ever makes is to pay
so.
That military
Where else
deposit.
Could he, you know, because it doesn't cost him a dime to find out how much he owes from his agency, number one, and that includes interest. And doesn't cost him a dime to apply for it. And then what if he decides to pay for it? You know, he can do the math himself and decide how quickly will he get his money back when he finds out how much he owes, including interest, and look at the difference with or without the military service in the computation of his pension.
Right. We're going to come back to the question about should I take Social Security or not, because we do have our caller on the line. I'd like to get to that person. Good morning, caller.
Good morning. I do have a question. I'm a federal employee, and I plan on working for a couple more years. I do turn 65 later this year, and I didn't know whether I should enroll in Medicare now or should I wait till I retire.
Oh, but you sound like a very young person who's about to turn 65. Thank you for calling this morning. And that's a very common question we get in the seminars. So if you want to hang on the line or hang up, and we will answer that for you. And that kind of ties in with the question about should I take Social Security or not.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about both qualifying and signing up for Medicare as an employee, as well as at the same time maybe signing up for Social Security. Now, the ages are different because the age to qualify for Medicare is 65. And for most people today, that is not your full Social Security age. So you might find yourself around 3 months before your 65th birthday, maybe think about signing up for Medicare. Can we talk a little bit about that first, James?
Sure. Now, if I'm still federally employed and I've got my employer health insurance coverage with me, I'm covered by FEHB coverage, I'm about to turn 65, I probably don't need to worry about Medicare yet.
Other than Part A.
Other than Part A. Part A is a no-brainer. It doesn't cost you a dime. You've been paying. Well, I shouldn't say it doesn't cost you anything because you've been paying since
1983 at least.
80 as a CSRS employee, or 1965 as an American paying right. Social Security or Medicare taxes. But you know that 1.45% of your pay that you pay every pay period, whether you're FERS or CSRS, that's that Medicare tax. It covers for Part A, which is hospitalization.
Mm-hmm.
There's no if you apply for Social Security and you're receiving a Social Security check by the time you're 65 years old, they will automatically enroll you in Part A. There's no opting out. But in this case, if you're 65 years old and you're making some good money, and there's an earnings test that we can talk about on another show that affects your Social Security benefits if you try to collect that Social Security before your full retirement age.
Mm-hmm. You won't be able to collect
which
it
because
you make
too much
money.
Which may not even be until 66 or 67 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You may not, you know, but, so you might not collect Social Security, but if I'm still working and I'm covered by my employer health insurance coverage, I don't need to worry about Medicare yet because my FEHB plan is still my primary provider.
Yeah, I would still contact Social Security, call the 800 number and get yourself enrolled. And they'll usually, they should, you know, normally this happens, they'll do an interview with you when they sign you up for Medicare to find out if you're still working, if you still are covered by current employer health insurance. And if so, the Social Security representative should advise you that you'd only need Part A at that time. Right. Although I have met people who got signed up for Part B who probably don't really get much benefit out of it because they are still working. So I would say I agree with you, Part A only. And then after retirement, if you're already 65 by the time you retire, you have a special enrollment for Part B that follows your retirement by 8 months.
That's right.
And during that time, you can sign up with no penalty for late enrollment in Part B. So that's normally when you'd consider the Part B enrollment.
Can you go over again what Part B covers? I think a lot of people are confused what A covers and what B covers.
Absolutely.
I mean, not in great detail, but just a little description.
Yeah, because the original Medicare was those two parts, Part A and Part B. And Part A of Medicare is what we sometimes refer to as hospital insurance. It covers the room and board, the nursing fees, you know, the hospital-related expenses when you go to stay overnight in the hospital.
Overnight.
So that's the only thing Part A is going to cover. It doesn't cover your doctor's care. It doesn't cover your prescriptions. It doesn't cover lab work or physical therapy. That all comes under Part B with the exception of prescriptions. So with Part B, you have your outpatient care, your doctor visits, lab work, durable medical equipment like walkers, canes, and wheelchairs, some skilled nursing care. So there's a whole range of benefits that Part B covers.
Sure.
But those are the same benefits in most cases that your federal health insurance covers.
That's right.
So while you're working, there's not necessarily any reason to have that dual coverage.
Yeah, there's always exceptions. And the few exceptions that I've seen was where there are some people that are still working with FEHB coverage. They got a lot of medical bills. Mm-hmm. They're going to see the doctor. They're basically rearranging their social schedule around their doctor appointments.
And their work schedule.
And sometimes it does benefit. Very few people, though. It's rare when it happens. But sometimes it benefits an employee who has employer coverage to sign up for Medicare Part B, but it's very rare. Usually,
if you find yourself with a lot of out-of-pocket expense, even though you have your federal health plan, that might be an indication that Part B might come in handy.
Yeah.
You know, talk to your doctors, talk to your physicians that you're seeing, and see if Medicare might help provide coverage for those expenses. But after retirement, what happens with a lot of the federal health plans is that because Medicare then becomes primary payer, many of your federal health plans will waive their deductibles, their co-payments, their co-insurance, which makes that combination of A, B, and FEHB a very nice, solid amount of health insurance
that
covers.
And only if you sign up for Part B.
If you take Part B, then you have virtually 100% coverage for everything but prescriptions and dental and vision.
Sure.
So something good. Now let's go back to the other question about should I take Social Security if I'm still working and I've reached the full retirement age when there is no longer an earnings limit. And this was someone who was under CSRS who has enough credits to qualify for Social Security. So they're kind of in a unique situation.
Yeah. They, you know, when this person, because he or she is under CSRS, when they retire, and notice I say when they retire, they're going to be subject to something called the windfall elimination provision, which might reduce, depending on how many years this person's paid Social Security taxes, it's possible it could reduce this person's Social Security check by about almost $400 a month.
Or in half if it's a small benefit.
That's right. That's right. It might split it in half. So, but the windfall elimination provision would not affect this person if this person started collecting Social Security now as an employee, because the windfall elimination provision does not affect you at all until you become a CSRS retiree.
Right.
So it might benefit this person to do some math, sit down at least for a few minutes and say, hey, if I start collecting Social Security now, because this person says that they're going to be working for maybe just a little bit longer for a few more years, or maybe next year, $699 a month, for the next 12 months, for example. Then I'm going to retire. That thing might be cut in half to be, looking more like $350 a month. I figure out my lifetime. How long am I going to live? How many months am I going to receive that benefit?
That's the eternal question.
If I were to wait a year from now, I might be able to collect maybe 108% of my Social Security benefit, because by waiting a year beyond your full retirement age, you're probably going to get another 8% extra per month.
They call it delayed credits, because Social Security says if you delay receiving it, we'll give you a bonus
that
we tack on permanently to your benefit.
That's right.
But again, if you don't live that long, will it be worth waiting for the bonus versus taking that full benefit while you're still working?
But 108% of your full benefit, 108% of $700 a month reduced by maybe $400 a month because of the WEP, it might be worth it for this person to maybe start collecting Social Security now once they reach their full retirement age as a CSRS employee, so that way they can at least collect the full benefit for a while before it's subject to the WEP.
Yeah, I think I'd lean towards go ahead and apply. The other issue that they should consider also is that if they start receiving that Social Security check on top of their full salary, keep in mind you're going to pay more taxes.
That's right. It might push them into a higher tax bracket.
Because part of that, most likely 85% of that Social Security benefit is going to be taxable income.
But something this person could think about, if it's going to push them up into a higher tax bracket or maybe pay more taxes, I would ask them, are they already contributing into TSP what the IRS allows them to contribute?
Good point.
$16,500 with their regular TSP contribution. And in this person's case, they can also do a $5,500 catch-up. If they are not, then maybe they can increase their TSP contributions by $700 a month.
I like that strategy.
Reducing their taxable income the same amount that they're receiving from Social Security.
And that money will be waiting for them when they retire.
That's right.
Good. I like that. That's a good answer.
It's a thought.
Very cool. Very cool. Okay, Ann, what's up next?
This person says next year they'll have 30 years in CSRS, and they'll also be turning 55 at the same time. This person said they attended a retirement seminar, and the instructor said that for CSRS, it is always better to retire at 30 years and then go to work for a contractor if the contractor would pay you the same or more salary. He said you would always come out ahead doing it this way.
Hmm.
What is our opinion at NITP?
Well, there's a lot of ifs, ands, and buts on that one, because there is no guarantee that you're going to find a job that's paying you the same salaries you were making as a federal employee. And even if you did, that new job might only offer 2 weeks vacation. It might be not located someplace convenient for you to get to.
They might lose a contract.
There's no job security.
You might have to still drive in the Washington, D.C. traffic.
Yeah.
So always is a strong word to use in any of this federal benefit stuff.
We never use always
always.
Do we? Never or always.
That's like saying one size of a shoe fits everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't. It's not true. It's not always better for everybody.
No. And what could be advantageous about that, if you did find that wonderful second career that paid the same salary, is if, and only if, you lived on one of those two checks. So in other words, you collect that retirement or you collect that new salary and you bank the other check. So that in the end, when you stop working eventually down the road, that you have a pool of money that you've saved up during those years that you worked that second career. Because keep in mind, if you stayed in the federal government beyond 30 years and you're under CSRS, you're going to keep accruing 2% of your high three. And your high three hopefully is going to continue to go up as years go by, assuming we don't have a permanent pay freeze.
Yeah.
And we get pay increases eventually.
Yeah.
So there is something to be said for staying in federal service longer, especially if you like your job and you're getting a lot of leave and you've kind of risen up through the ranks where you might not have that cubicle with no windows and you now have a view of the outside. So there's something to be said for maintaining your federal career long enough that you could retire and not have to have a second career.
Yeah.
So it really depends on what you want to do.
It really does. I've seen the other side of the fence, too, where the contractor job is there. It's the same office, same desks, maybe even the same pay, maybe even slightly more. In other words, the same seniority. Everybody treats you the same. You're the same Bob that's been working with that everybody's been working with for the past 20, 30 years in this case, for example. So it just really depends, but I don't think you can say always.
No, you have to do the math. This is another math problem, because you're going to have that second income, but you're also going to have some things you might lose as a result of changing careers and doing maybe a different job in
health
a different place.
Health insurance coverage becomes a taxable item, for example, for most of these retirees. It's a pre-tax item as an
for
employee.
Employees.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different things.
Yeah, will you still be able to contribute to something like the thrift? We have a 401k plan.
They may not. They may or may not have something or they may have something better. You never know. They may have a contractor job, may have a private 401k plan that has better, investments.
But I think the only problem we have with that question is the word always.
That's right.
I think it is worth exploring. A lot of people do work a second career and they want to work that second career. Some people work a second career, but it's at a much lower salary. So in that case, you want to make sure you have enough retirement so you can do something like that.
Yeah,
so
it's not always about money. Sometimes it's about happiness, too.
Exactly.
It's not always that you need that extra money.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you're taking that contractor job because it's less stress.
Yep.
There's some contractor jobs that have more stress than the federal employee has.
And you worry about the next contract.
That's right.
Yeah. So I think that settles that one fairly well. These are all open-ended because we can never definitively answer those questions. It's really something you have to work on. You really have to think about it in your own situation.
And it goes back to, as long as you are aware of what your options are, you can clearly set down on paper what your options are, and you decide for yourself. And sometimes you need a financial planner to help you with that. Sometimes you don't. But, Tammy and I do, we just help you understand what those options are, and then you got to go and make those decisions yourself.
Right. You have a variety of specialists you can get in touch with as you start to plan retirement. But I think it's important to understand what each one of those people do. You have people who specialize in helping someone find a job. They help you write a resume. They help you see what the job market is out there. Those are career specialists, career transition specialists. You might need a tax consultant. That last email was about, Social Security and how's that going to increase my taxable income. You might have to call your tax advisor, see what they think. If you need enough money to be able to afford your same lifestyle in retirement, you're not sure if your retirement's going to provide that for you or what your options are, maybe a financial advisor. And as James and I do, we can help you understand what you're entitled to as far as your federal health insurance, your Social Security benefits, your retirement benefit. What are those benefits worth? How do you get them? What happens if you work a little longer? So there's a lot of different specialties that can help plan for retirement. And that's one of the things in our seminars. Ann could tell you this better than anybody, that most agencies, when they put on a pre-retirement seminar, they won't just have a benefits specialist. What other specialties do we provide?
Oh, we have financial planning. We have income tax planning, health and fitness, estate planning, and then the fun one, transition to retirement, that talks about the psychological aspects of retirement, how to get along with your spouse, what to do if you're single in your retirement years, opportunities, travel, leisure.
And these are all different people. These
all
are
different speakers because they're all experts in their field.
That's right. And I think that's what's unique, I think, about the seminars that we put on. I know a lot of other companies do a similar thing where it's not just one person trying to cover all those specialties because it's not something we can be specializing in. I don't know how I could learn more than what we know just about benefits.
I would never want to be a financial planner or a tax planner.
No, and I think that financial planners and tax planners say the same about us. They wouldn't
want to
know about all
either.
The benefits.
Right.
So, what's next, Ann?
Tammy, could you read that phone number again? I was hoping we'd get more callers today.
Sure.
If you could
somebody
read that number again, just
in
case, because it always makes us happy when we get a caller.
That's true. It's 1-877-936-9333. 877-936-9333. And we are here until about the next 10 minutes or so, maybe 15 minutes. So we'd be more than happy to have you call in. Otherwise, we'll continue down our email list.
Okay. This one is about a question on age and health at retirement. Should those be considered in determining to keep the basic insurance at 100%? Paying $2,000 yearly for a $100,000 term makes more sense at 65 than at 56. Agree?
Okay, this is someone who's asking a question about government life
insurance.
Or FEGLI, as we call it.
Mm-hmm.
And basic FEGLI is life insurance that every federal employee is enrolled in as soon as they're hired. And it's always valued at your salary, rounded up to the next thousand plus 2,000. And as your salary increases and as your age goes up, hopefully your salary goes up as well, and the amount of life insurance goes up. But the employees pay, at least from age 45 on, you pay 15 cents per thousand biweekly to maintain that coverage. So on $100,000 worth of coverage, you'd be paying $15 every 2 weeks to maintain that coverage enrollment, or $50,000 coverage, you'd be paying $7.50 every 2 weeks. So that's your basic life insurance. It kind of just stays with you throughout your federal career. But when you retire, and when you're filling out your retirement application, whether you're CSRS or FERS, you're going to make an election on how you want that basic life insurance to go with you into retirement. Assuming you've had it for at least the last 5 years, it's going to follow you. But James, do you want to explain what those three options are you have to choose from? Because you can check box one, which is called the 75% reduction, box two, which is the 50% reduction, or box three, no reduction. So as long as you live, you'll have the full value of that benefit that you had on the last day you worked. So which one do people choose, and
so
how do you choose between?
Yeah, you listed all three of them. Those, if you decide to carry basic life insurance into retirement, you have a 75 or a 50% or a no reduction option. If you choose the no reduction option, that's the most expensive option up front. You know, and of course, the cost of your life insurance will be, you know, the basic will be based on which option you choose and also how old you are at the time of separation for retirement. So if you're younger than 65 years old, I don't have it memorized, but it's pretty expensive. It's over $2 per $1,000 worth of coverage for the no reduction option. That's a lot. That's seven times as much as what you're paying right now.
That's right.
If you want to keep your life insurance costs the same in retirement, if you're retiring before the age of 65, you could go with the 75% reduction. You know, you're going to be paying about 32.5 cents per $1,000 worth of coverage. That's about what you're paying
it's
now.
Exactly
that's
what
a monthly.
You're paying right
yeah,
now. It's just
that's
a monthly withholding
versus
rather
a bi-weekly.
Than bi-weekly. Right.
And so the coverage, you know, the election, when I counsel folks about their life insurance coverage, I tell them that whatever election that you're making, it's not about right now necessarily at the date of your retirement. It's what coverage does your family need or your friends need if you die after the age of 65? Because if you pass away before the age of 65, between the date of retirement and age 65, no matter which one of those three options you choose, your family gets the same basic insurance amount. And your BIA, your basic insurance amount, is always based on your final salary. And like Tammy said, round it up to your nearest thousand, add $2,000 to that. That will always be your BIA for retirement purposes.
Mm-hmm.
If you choose a 75% reduction, you only pay those premiums until you're 65 years old. So if you
free.
Had a $100,000 policy, for example, that would cost you about $32.50 a month. When you turn 65, you're still alive. Your retirement check goes up $32.50 a month.
You stop paying the premiums.
You stop paying for the premiums for the rest of your life. The benefit will never reduce to zero, but at the age of 65 and you're retired, the benefit will begin to reduce at the rate of 2% per month. Until 3 years have gone by, it takes 3 years to get down to the full 75% reduction. There will be no less than 25% payable for the rest of your life. You'll
right.
essentially be 68 years old. So the question I would ask myself when I'm 57 or 58 years old at the time of retirement, because you do have to make an election mm-hmm. when you're applying for retirement, what you're telling OPM, this is what I want to do with my FEGLI, is what does my family need if I were to die after the age of 65?
Right.
And if I felt like my family needed more than 25% payable by the time I'm 68, then I might want to start looking at the 50% or the no reduction
mm-hmm.
options. Now, when you look at the 50% reduction option, it's going to cost you three times as much. You know, it's over 90 cents per $1,000 worth of coverage per month, you know, between the date of retirement and age 65. And again, if you pass away before the age 65, your family doesn't get three times as much. They still get the same basic insurance amount.
Mm-hmm.
When you start looking at the 50% or the no reduction options, if you're healthy, I would encourage people to shop around. You might be able to find a better deal with some of their private life, private sector life insurance than
right.
a 50%.
Right. The one benefit to FEGLI and making one of those three elections mm-hmm. at retirement is the fact they don't ask you how's your health.
That's right.
They just say which one you want.
Whichever one you want, you get it. So if I was not insurable mm-hmm. and I couldn't find a better deal than 90-something cents per $1,000 of coverage, there's nothing wrong with choosing a 50%. Or paying over $2 per $1,000 for coverage per month if I want to go with the no reduction option.
Mm-hmm.
The 50% reduction option, if you choose that one, again, if you die before the age of 65, you know, it's full payout, but you're paying over 90 cents per $1,000 for the coverage. But at the age of 65, it's not free. It drops down to about 60 cents per $1,000 for the coverage. But the benefit doesn't reduce as quickly as the 75% reduction. It only reduces at the rate of 1% per month until 50.
About 4 years.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So you'll be 69 years old to be a 50% payout.
Right,
but again, if you felt like you're making this decision at the time of retirement. So if
and
you felt
this
like
this is only the basic coverage too, because you might also have optional coverage. You might
right.
have the five multiples under option B, which is another decision you have to decide. How much of that are you willing to pay for? Because that one goes up every 5 years with your age.
That's right.
So like you said, the very first thing you want to do is evaluate how much life insurance do I need?
That's right.
Because what I bought when I was 25 years old or 35 years old is certainly not the same amount of coverage I need today.
Yeah.
Now, I might have bought life insurance because I started my family at age 28 and I bought my first house at age 32. So I needed coverage that what if something happened, who's going to raise these kids? Who's going to pay off this house? Which now at age 58 might be paid off and the kids are got kids of their own.
Well,
so I may not have a need for that
right.
life insurance.
Most of us need less life insurance as we get older. You know,
right.
I may not have my house paid off when I'm 57 mm-hmm. or 58 the day of retirement, but maybe
you might
by
have
my
enough
mid-60s.
Money in a bank to pay for it.
Yeah, maybe by my mid-60s. That's right. Maybe I'll have it paid off. And so I just don't need as much life insurance as I get older. Most of us, we got our kids through school, we got our houses paid off. You know, we just don't need as much.
Right. And a lot of times people will start around that age, 55, 60, when they start evaluating their needs for the life insurance, saying, well, I don't need as much. It's getting awfully expensive to keep it. So maybe I'll drop some of the life insurance that pays a benefit upon my death and maybe pick up some long-term care insurance that I can use while I'm living to have a better quality of life during those
right.
final years. So I think that might be one of the reasons why some people tend to purchase long-term care insurance in mid-50s, early 60s, because that's when they start to think less of needing the life insurance and maybe more of what if I need long-term care?
Yeah, and to address this guy's point more specifically, he said you want to look at your age and health to keep the basic insurance at 100%. Well, if I was 57 years old and I just went to go see a doctor and the doctor gave me a bad bill of health, said, James, if you're lucky, you got 12 months to live, and I'm filling out my paperwork to retire, I would probably go with the 75% reduction option. That's me personally.
Well, because you would still have the full benefit,
right,
whether you elected either one of those.
I don't think I'm going to make it to 65. My family would get the full basic insurance amount. Why would I want to pay three times or seven times as much for basic life insurance if I don't expect to live that long?
But if you were 72 years old with that same prognosis, you might choose the no reduction.
Yeah, I would always go get a second opinion, but
hopefully you'd outlive that prognosis.
Right. But yeah, that's right. I would probably go with the no reduction option. You know, if I was older than 65 years old and had a bad bill of health, I might be willing to pay, it's like $1.80 per, per $1,000 worth of coverage.
Right.
I might be willing to pay that to make sure that basic insurance amount doesn't increase so dramatically.
Right. The other thing, too, when you're planning to retire or any time really during your careers, consider the fact, when was the last time you looked at your beneficiary designations? Because you're leaving this money to somebody. Do you even know who it is going to be that's going to receive the benefit of that election? So throughout the course of your career, and again, beginning with the day you were hired, you had the opportunity to file beneficiary forms for life insurance, for thrift savings plan, for retirement, and even for unpaid compensation in the event an employee dies in service. So make sure you put that on one of your to-do lists, is to update your beneficiary forms either today or whenever you have a life event that might change those needs.
And a will does not affect the beneficiary forms.
That's right, because these follow federal precedents. Your will was written under state law, so don't think because you filed a will that that's going to take care of this.
Whoever's on the beneficiary form gets that money first.
Still comes first.
A lot of people, when they remember when they came on board 10, 15, 20 years ago, and remember all that paperwork that they shoved in front of you? All you want to do is get to your desk and get to work.
Yeah, you have no idea.
So you filled it out as quickly as you could. You turned some of it in. Some of it was required. Some of it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Some of it you took home. Some of it you brought back. But who remembers exactly what all forms you filled out? And if you don't remember, I would be setting up an appointment tomorrow.
Yeah, and so those beneficiary forms are 37 years old. They're still valid.
You got your ex-boyfriend or girlfriend on that unpaid compensation form. How upset or angry would your current widow or a widower would be if you were to pass away today and your current spouse does not get your last paycheck, mm-hmm, and does not get your lump sum annual leave payment.
Right, exactly. And it can cause just administrative problems with trying to straighten those things out, or legal problems with trying to verify who was supposed to be the beneficiary. So, yeah, do your family a favor and keep those current up to date. Or if you want things to follow your family trust you've set up, make your beneficiary payable to the trust.
That's right. Designate the trust or mm-hmm will with that beneficiary.
Right. Form. Or if you want it to go according to standard precedent so that your spouse, your children, your parents, or your will is next in line, then cancel prior designations. File a new form and just put on there cancel prior designations. And those are all different ways you can maintain the validity of those elections.
Yeah, I've personally processed, I had the unfortunate business of processing several death and service cases. And me personally, I think it is good, whether you like the federal order of precedence or not, that even if you like it, you might want to go ahead and fill out the beneficiary forms, because it makes it easier on those folks, like your agencies and
right
OPM, who
and
have the contact.
It's clear who
it's
you
very
really
clear
met
who's going to get the money, because you'd be surprised who comes out of the woodworks claiming to be your long-lost stepchildren.
Absolutely.
Whenever you pass away. And it just makes it easier for these for these people that you care about to get the money sooner,
right,
or to get the benefits sooner than
and
otherwise.
Quickly taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
What's next, Dan?
It's all about reemployed annuitants.
Okay.
I think we have time to cover this one.
Yep.
Can the annuitant contribute CSRS voluntary contributions if the break in service is more than 3 days? Next, there's several questions here.
Well, let's start.
Let's start
first
with that.
Well, let's start just with the fact of what is a reemployed annuitant, because mm-hmm now in the government we have couple of different situations, because there's a need in some agencies to rehire retirees to bring back the experience that employee had, or maybe there's a special project they were working on. Maybe there's an emergency need like we had after 9/11. So there's some special provisions where agencies can take advantage of hiring back retirees under this special reemployed annuitant program versus the original reemployed annuitant program. So can you distinguish between those two?
The special program is kind of like something that's always been available in the past, but agencies used to have to go to OPM to request a waiver of, typically what's happened in the past is if someone got rehired as an annuitant, and you're rehired by an agency and they're already receiving a retirement check, it depends on whether they were CSR CFRs. In most cases, what happens is when they get rehired, the agency takes the salary and reduces the salary by, offsets it by 100% of whatever the person's already in receipt of from OPM as far as
so you're really
check
only working for the difference between
right
your salary and the retirement. But with the advantage of if you stay a year, in that new employment, you can qualify for supplemental retirement added on to your original.
Right.
If you stay five years, you can have a whole recomputed retirement.
Right.
So this would be for someone who may be retired and then finds this wonderful federal job opportunity and wants to go back to work and doesn't care that they're not going to get both checks.
That's right.
But they could then qualify for a higher retirement later.
Right. But under the new program, or under the old program, if the employee wasn't going to take the job, like the reemployed or the annuitant says, I'm not going to come back on, you know, I'm getting $5,000 a month from OPM, and I'm eligible to receive $10,000 a month from you, but you're only going to give me $5,000 a month?
Because
of the offset? No, thank you. Well, if the agency really needs that person, that's the person is the only person that can really do that job, you know, to fulfill that agency's need, then the agency in the past used to be able to go to OPM and apply for a waiver of the salary offset. And then if the OPM approved it, then they can give them the full $10,000 a month salary, plus the person keeps their $5,000 a month pension. Mm-hmm. Well, under the new rules, OPM has kind of given the ability for a lot of these agencies to make those decisions for themselves. But you got to keep in mind, if your salary is not going to be reduced, you're not going to be allowed to contribute to TSP, and you're not going to be able to become earn entitlement to any pension.
No supplemental, no recomputed annuity, which
That's right.
also would mean no voluntary contributions under that situation.
Now, there are some benefits to still be had. When you return as a reemployed annuitant with the waiver where you get your full salary and you keep your pension, you can still have your health insurance put back underneath your agency and you can reduce your taxable income.
Mm-hmm.
There are some benefits.
There are some. But those are generally limited appointments as well,
where
you couldn't stay 5 or 10 years.
Right.
You're limited to usually 2 years or 4 years, maybe if you're part-time.
That's correct.
But if you did come back under the offset program where your new salary is being offset, then you could invest in voluntary contributions.
Absolutely.
You'd have all the same rights as any other federal employee would have with in terms of life insurance elections, TSP contributions, and retirement, well as voluntary contributions.
Correct.
Were there some other...
In this particular case, he said 3 days, though, right? 3 days.
Yes.
So it just depends on if he already had a voluntary contribution account and took the money out, he would have had he would have had at least a break of a year before he could set up a new voluntary contribution account.
To put the money back in again.
That's right.
Yeah, we are winding down near the end of our hour. This really went fast for me. We're talking about what's near and dear to all of our hearts here, so that's why it's gone so quickly. But any final thoughts, James, on what an employee can do as they prepare for retirement from federal service or what to expect?
Well, you know, it's never too early to start, you know, because a lot of these people that are in these classes, they said, oh, I wish somebody would have told me this 10, 15, 20 years ago when I started my career. So never too early to start getting some counseling from your retirement officers. You know, at least make sure your service is up to date. Make sure your agency has all your service together, all your federal service.
Who do you contact?
Your personnel office. They have different names. Every agency has a different name for it. You know, sometimes they call them benefits offices, personnel offices, HR.
Sometimes they're within your own place where you work. Sometimes they're contracted out.
Sometimes they're in another part of the world.
Another state.
That's right. So it's just your you know, go through your boss if you have to. Find out who your HR, human resource people are, and just start getting some ideas. It's never too late to never too early either, though.
Great advice.
Yeah.
Ann, thank you for being here today. Who's on next week?
Oh, our very special guests, Greg Long and Tom Tribuco from the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board.
Perfect.
Perfect.
We look forward to next week. Have a great week, everyone. See you Monday.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
Cybersecurity runs deeper than information assurance. It includes mobile security, cyber innovations, forensics, collaboration. That's why last month the Defense Department increased its cyber